Hi, it's David Remnick, and I've got a quick but important note before we start. Up till now, the podcast of the New Yorker Radio Hour has been the same hour-long program that we put on the radio. We're changing that. We're going to give you two episodes, same contents, but we've rearranged it for the best podcast listening experience, because we know an hour can be a lot to tackle sometimes. So we'll post the second part of the show in a couple of days. If you want to hear exactly the hour that we broadcast on the radio, no problem. You can always do that at newyorkerradio.org. You can play it right off the homepage. And listen, this is important. Please let me know what you think of the new format. Email us at newyorkerradio@wnyc.org. And here's the episode.
They're trying to answer questions about upward mobility in America.
He's the military strategist. It was profiled brilliantly by somebody.
And so I think if you could, find a subculture of people.
With a kind of form of life on this planet that we haven't really seen before.
From One World Trade Center in Manhattan, this is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker.
Welcome to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. This week on the show, we bring you two great American songwriters, James Taylor and Lucinda Williams. They're just a few years apart in age, children of the baby boom and the early rock and roll era. But their careers took a very different path. Taylor was just a kid when he recorded his first album at Apple Records in London, with help from the Beatles. And he really became a musical touchstone for his generation almost immediately. For Williams, it was the late 90s already when she was on her way to 50. And she had a hit with the record Car Wheels on a Gravel Road. It's an almost perfect mix of country and blues and folk, and it arrived just as a younger generation was falling in love with a genre now known as Americana. We're going to hear performances from both artists recorded at the New Yorker Festival, which always takes place over an early fall weekend. And to kick things off, here's my colleague Adam Gopnik, a staff writer at the New Yorker for 30 years.
James, this evening runs the risk of being an episode in the Chris Farley show. I don't know if you remember Chris Farley on Saturday Night Live, when he would have people he admired on, he would just say, do you remember when you wrote Fire and Rain? And say, that was great. And I could go through everything you've done and simply stand here and sweat and say, that was great. But I will try at least to find out why it's all been so great. Thinking about your music, one of the things that's always sort of stunned me about it is when you first appeared, you had a distinctive way of playing the guitar, which wasn't like anybody else's, distinctive kind of voicings, and you had an amazing harmonic language. You know, I always think when I go through your sheet music and see that wonderful song like Don't Let Me Be Lonely Tonight starts with an E minor ninth chord and then goes to a major seventh chord. Those weren't the C, A minor, F, G progressions of pop music at the time. Did you study music? How was it that the language of music came to be the language you speak so naturally?
I studied cello when I was a kid. My parents thought it would be good for, there were five of us, and so I got the cello, and I played for about 4 years, badly, reluctantly. I was a bad student, and it never gave me the kind of feedback that I needed to have it take off and have its own momentum, its own reason to continue. But all along, I noticed that the guitar was going to be it for me, and I finally prevailed on my folks. We lived in North Carolina. My mother would bring little groups of us up on the train to Manhattan to expose us to something other than trees, and.
Was it art or music or
yeah, it was,
the shows that yeah, she took you to?
Museums and shows, and the city itself. My folks loved the Rodgers and Hammerstein, Rodgers and Hart, Cole Porter, My Fair Lady in South Pacific and Oklahoma, and some light classics and some folk music too. They had Lead Belly, they had Pete Seeger, they had Gene Redpath, a sort of a Celtic singer. Mm-hmm. We listened to Tom Lehrer, those great
Tom Lehrer records.
The satirical
National Brotherhood Week and
right.
Oh, the poor folks hate the rich folks, and the rich folks hate the poor folks. All of my folks hate all of your folks. It's American as apple pie, but during
National Brotherhood Week. National Brotherhood Week. New Yorkers.
Yeah, I think that those, I've always thought of those show tunes as being the pinnacle of American popular music, really the best it ever got. And of course, I loved Elvis, and I loved the Beatles, and I loved Ray Charles when I was exposed to those things. That's sort of the second tier of stuff I was exposed to. That amazed me, too, and it just opened my eyes, and I wanted to explore that music, and I wanted to sing it, I wanted to play it. But I was 12 when I got a guitar here in Manhattan at Shermer's.
Really?
The Shermer Music Company.
So you drove up with your mother to...
Well, we took the train up, and I think it was my mom and my dad on that trip. And we went to Shermer's and found a guitar. I saw the Fender Electrics, the shape, the amazing finish of them, the way they looked, the chrome, the mother of toilet seat, you know. they wouldn't go for it. So it was a classic guitar, and I... You know, immediately I got, I'll show you what the first thing I ever played on it was. Simple, but it spoke to me, it just immediately started making sounds that I wanted to hear more of.
And
the cello never did.
You sold the cello at that point and pawned it on 46th Street.
I don't know what happened to that damn cello. It's got to be around somewhere. I hope someone's playing it.
And you started to compose just the way kids do, teenagers do on the guitar. You just chord to chord and idea to idea. What was the first song you ever wrote that you thought was a good song?
I wrote a song called, when I was 13 or 14, called Roll River Roll, which is pretty awful. I can play it for you.
Would you please?
Yes.
I don't think this is ever here. James Taylor's first song. Has this been widely covered, James?
No, it hasn't been widely covered. And the fact that nobody here tonight has ever heard it is proof of how lame it was. You know, it was really... This is something called Travis picking that we all learned.
Right.
Sort of a walking thumb, and then the one or two fingers thrown in.
Roll, river, roll, long as you can be, longest river I've done seen, roll into sea.
Went like that.
And then more of it. But you know, the strange thing is, James, I never heard that. It sounds like a James Taylor song, you know? I mean.
Yeah, it does.
You know, not the oompa part, maybe so much at the beginning, but the way that the bass line goes down and goes to the, and all of that.
It sounds on the minor.
And it's on the minor, exactly, yeah. In that.
Yeah, it does. It had a certain.
It hints at things you will write.
Yes,
if not, yeah, if it isn't. So you'd play these things, and then you would, and then your first band then came together with you playing and composing.
There were open mic nights at a lot of these coffee houses. They were really little sort of ad hoc on the cheap nightclubs, night spots that would spring up without a liquor license. And there was a circuit that of people who played them. Tom Rush was and the Quescon Jug Band, and Dylan started in those clubs, and Joan Baez, and you could go maybe on a Tuesday night or a Wednesday night, a slow night. They'd have open mic, and regular civilians could come and bring their guitar and try their
roll,
stuff
river,
out.
Roll,
and try Roll River Roll,
roll
in front
the,
of the yeah.
Everybody. I think everybody here knows that you went off to London eventually, and you recorded that first record. How old were you when you did that, James?
I guess I was 19 when I went to London and got my recording contract with Apple Records with the Beatles, and that was such an amazing reversal of fortune for me. That was the door that opened and let me through to the life that I've lived ever since. And it was my big break. I'd been at it since, you know, when I came to New York in 1966, and instead of graduating high school, I came here and I started with Danny Kortchmar, a band called The Flying Machine, which was it was ill-fated, and we had problems, and you know, typical problems, and never got our recording deal that we needed. We signed one, but the people who signed it just they couldn't follow through with it. So, and after that, fell to pieces in '66 when I was 18. I went home to North Carolina to recover a little bit. I needed soup. I needed a bed. You know, I needed my parents. I needed to go home. You know, my dad actually heard me on the phone. I called him in North Carolina from New York, and the band had been broken up for about a month, and he could hear that I wasn't well, and he said, "You just stay right there." He got my address. He said, "You stay right there, I'll be there in 10 hours." And he was.
That's wonderful.
I just sat there for 10 hours, and my dad showed up in a station wagon and took me home. That's one of my, you know, my treasures, that memory, that thing he did. I wrote a song about it called Jump Up Behind Me.
This land is a lovely green, it reminds me of my own home. Such children I've seldom seen, even in my own home. The sky's so bright and clean.
Well, speaking of that, one of the things that was so potent about your music when, as a very young man, people first started paying attention to it, was that it seemed to be so amazingly emotionally accessible. It seemed to sum up so many of the longings of a generation, so many people, a song like Rainy Day Man or Something's Wrong. And then more famously in the next go round and the next group of songs, Fire and Rain and those things. Was it strange and difficult to see your own experience turning into songs and then becoming these kinds of universal vehicles for other people's feelings?
Very strange indeed. And, you know, I think that's, you obviously you want success, you want to be heard, you want to be listened to and encouraged. But it's always that moment of going from the private thing, and in the case of a singer-songwriter who doesn't have a band who's sort of going there with him, and a sort of a posse or a crowd or a tribe that's you're running with and doing it with, when you're doing it alone and by yourself, it is a very strange transition to make. And I wrote songs about that too. Hey, Mister, That's Me Up on the Jukebox, or Fading Away, or Company Man. Those are songs about, you know, the difficulty of starting off with a very private and personal thing. And as my friend David Crosby says, you know, the first album you make is the result of 10 years of work. Then you've got a year to make the next one. You know? But those first songs weren't written with an audience in mind, except in the most general sense. They really were personal, like diary entries or poems that you write for yourself. But then when you take this stuff to market and engage the music business and the popular culture and all that stuff, it can be a very interesting thing to try to negotiate and to make to go public with it and to make a living. I'm sure that writing has a similar thing to it when you take your work to market. In my case, I've sort of been myself for a living, you know, sort of a publicly led life or a lot of it.
But it had to be, you were saying, it had to be peculiar because, yes, of course, it's true for everyone, but a writer, maybe six people read it. When a musician genuinely develops a following, it's millions of people who see your music as their internal, not just as your journal, but as their internal diary. And that's an extraordinarily rich time, must be your life. What's the first song of that body of work that you feel, a lot of it you still perform, that you feel is strong, is a finished song that you feel good about?
I guess Something in the Way She Moves is probably the first song that I had written, Knocking Around the Zoo, and a song called Sunshine, Sunshine, before Something in the Way She Moves. And actually all the songs on the first album, some of them before, some of them after Something in the Way She Moves, but that was the first one that I thought really worked as a song, yeah.
You still do material from that period, and and I know you've talked about a lot. But one of the things that interests me, if you don't mind, just to fast forward a little bit, as a listener of yours, as a follower of yours, one of the things that seemed to me to be true, and I wonder if it was true, is that some in the kind of mid-70s, you were searching a bit for a sound, for work. And then beginning in the late 70s, you started doing a couple of things. You started doing covers for the first time. You started doing Motown covers, How Sweet It Is, and so on. And it seemed as though there was a kind of rebirth through sort of being free to do other people's work as well as yours and sort of shedding the skin of Sweet Baby James and of that material. Was that a fantasy, or did you feel some of that?
You know, it just wasn't very carefully considered ahead of time. All of those cover tunes that I would do were things that would be thought of at the spur of the moment in the recording studio after we had already recorded two songs that day. That's the way it was with How Sweet It Is. That's the way it was with Handyman. Mm-hmm. We've already cut two things that we were prepared to cut, and we've just burned through the first hour of a three-hour recording session, and we're going to be paying for it anyway. So you still feel strong and energetic, and Cooch says, why don't we try How Sweet It Is?
How sweet it is to be loved by you. How sweet it is to be loved by you.
James Taylor talking with Adam Gopnik at the New Yorker Festival. Ahead this hour, we'll hear a live performance from James Taylor. It's the New Yorker Radio Hour. Stick around.
Needed someone to understand my ups and downs. There you were. With sweet love and devotion. Deeply touching my emotion. I want to stop. Thank you, baby. I want to stop.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. James Taylor joined Adam Gopnik in conversation at the New Yorker Festival, and they talked there about how Taylor formed his very distinctive sound, which was so influenced by Brazilian music, and in particular, Antonio Carlos Jobim.
You have that beautiful song, Only a Dream in Rio. Did Brazilian music open up your ears and your musical vocabulary?
It sure did. I mentioned the Broadway stuff, the folk music, and the light classics that my parents listened to, and some satirical stuff, Tom Lehrer. The next level of that was what my brother Alex brought into the house. He brought Ray Charles and Joe Tex and Don Covey and the Hot Nuts and the, which were a beach music band. And his stuff extended into some light jazz. And one of them was that great album recorded in 1963 in 3 days here in Manhattan. Astrid Gilberto, João Gilberto, Girl from Ipanema.
Tall and thin and young and lovely, the girl from Ipanema goes walking, and when she passes, each one she passes goes.
And that stuff had a huge effect on me. I loved the chords. I loved the, you know, for a guitarist, that Brazilian thing is just a rich vein to get into. And man, I couldn't get enough. So Only a Dream in Rio has its roots in that, and a lot of my stuff does, starting with Sunny Skies, probably, which is a very simple
kind of Jobim.
Well, it's not really, but it. It's more like a Beatles beat, you know, that.
Right.
That's only a two chord song, just those two, but it, with a walk with the thumb sort of playing in opposition to the fingers. That was a Brazilian influence, and then that song more recently, the That, the idea of that song is, it was sort of like one note samba. It's just that da na da 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 da, and then the changes,
the harmony move,
underneath it, and that's a very Brazilian, very Jobim thing to do. So I was hugely impressed by that stuff, and it was a great source for me.
I never thought Sonny said sort of like the kind of rhythm of getting better with.
That's right, what would you do if I sang out of room? Would you stand up and walk out on me? Boom, ba-dum, boom. Yeah, what happened is I developed a little bit of a guitar style from playing Christmas carols. and hymns from school. God, that's Deutschland über alles, too, isn't it?
That is. That's the part you want to keep quiet, if you can, James. That influence, you really want to.
No, I only learned. Play that down a bit. I only came to realize that later. We can cut. We can edit right here. Hi. So, yeah. I played hymns, I played Christmas carols, and it gave me that sort of very bedrock kind of Western musical
Bach harmony,
that kind of thing. And from then I fell into the Beatles and Jobim, and it really I found that I had enough of a technique to be able to adapt those things into it. But the technique itself, I think I'm playing Ray Charles, I think I'm playing Jobim, I think I'm playing Paul McCartney, Lennon McCartney, I think I'm playing Holland Dozier Holland, I think I'm, but actually, or Sam Cooke or Marvin Gaye, but it actually is put through this sort of narrow filter of my technique.
Of your guitar fingering.
And it makes it sound like James Taylor, like, Carol's Tune Up on the Roof, which we did all summer long, and we went back and forth between her version of it and mine. It started being when this whole world starts a-getting me down, and people are just too much for me to fade. Well, when I adapted the tune and we did it, it was like, when this old world starts a-getting me down, and people are just too much for me to fade. I climb way up to the top of the stairs, and all my cares are just right and deep. Oh, no, no, la, 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 la.
All that inner voicing of the, so now we know.
Right, so it gets really.
Beatles chords, Beatles beats, Brazilian chords, and Bach harmonies, and you have a James Taylor tune. It's just too painful to have James Taylor up here and not hear you play. Would you play a few things for us? Okay. Thank you.
circles around the sun. Never give up, never slow down, never grow old, never ever die young. Synchronize with the rising moon. Even with the evening star, they were true love, all written in stone. They were never alone, they were never that far apart. And we who couldn't bear to believe they might make it, we got to close our eyes, yeah, to cut up our losses into doable doses and press in our tears and sighs. You can see him on the street on a Saturday night. Everyone used to run them down. They're a little too sweet, they're a little too tight. They're not enough tough for this town, though. We couldn't touch him with a 10-foot pole. No, it didn't seem to rattle at all. They were fused together, body and soul. That much more with their backs up against the wall. Oh, hold them up, hold them up. Never do let them fall. Pray to the dust and the rust and the ruin that names us, shames us, claims us all. Guess it had to happen someday soon. There wasn't nothing to hold them down. They would rise from among us like a big balloon. Take the sky and forsake the ground. Yes, other hearts were broken, and I know other dreams ran dry, but our golden ones sailed on and on. To another land beneath another sky. Let other hearts be broken. Let other dreams run dry. Let our golden ones sail on and on. To another land beneath another sky. The sky. Hold them up, 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 won't you hold them up?
I'm going to play that first song, very early song, first presentable song, I think, that I ever wrote. Well, there's something in the way she moves, looks my way or calls my name, that seems to leave this troubled world behind. And if I'm feeling down and blue, and troubled by some foolish game, she always seems to make me change my mind. I feel fine anytime that she's around me now. She's around me now, almost all the time. I'm
well, you can tell she's been with me now. She's been with me now quite a long, long time, and I feel fine. Every now and then things I'd lean on lose their meaning, and I find myself convening into places where I should never let me go. She has a powder gold, but no one else can find me, and they silently remind me of the happiness and good times that I know, you know. Well, I guess I just got to know them. It isn't what she's got to say, how she thinks or where she's been. To me, the words are nice the way they sound. I like to hear them best that way. Doesn't much matter what they mean. She says them mostly just to calm me down. I feel fine anytime that she's around me now. She's around me now. I mean, just about all the time. If I'm well, you can tell that she's been with me now. She's been with me now quite a long time, quite a long, long time, and I feel fine.
I have been playing, I have two children, and for the last 16 years, I've been playing You Can Close Your Eyes for them every night when they go to sleep. And they always ask me, Daddy, did you make up that song? And I say, I did, actually.
Yes, of course.
But now they're here tonight, and they'll be aware that I didn't, actually. James did. But I wonder if on behalf of this audience, who I know are all moving their fingers, would you teach me to play that song properly?
I will indeed, yes. So let's get a guitar.
Is there a guitar? Could I get one?
Guitar and plug it in.
Thank you.
I bring two in case. These are Olsen guitars made by a guy in Minneapolis, St. Paul, and he managed in 1985 to get one into a hotel room that I was checking into in Minneapolis, and I've never looked back. So this is the first one and this is the most recent one he built. So
I'll take it home tonight. We're in D, which Miles Davis said was the key that belonged to you.
Well, it's true. I met Miles Davis once up on 94th Street, and it was it's one of those things that you take as with you as a great the great man. Indeed, that he noticed me enough to mention. He said, "You know, D's your key."
The Oracle had spoken.
The Oracle had spoken. So that's it.
And D was your key. So we start on D. So where it's.
The sun is shorty. Sing again now.
That's good. Actually, before we go, that is. Before we go any further, I sing this song at home too, and I've actually more and more recently gotten used to singing it with my dear wife Kim, who is here, and I'm gonna pull it. She's gonna kill me. Pull
Kim
me up. Pull her up on stage. She's here somewhere. Oh, she is here.
Hi, Kim. Hello.
Good.
So this is sort of like open mic night.
It's open mic night. That's right. We are. We're going to go out with a whimper here. So again.
When the sun is surely sinking down, but the moon is slowly rising, so this whole world must still be spinning around, and I still love you. So close your
That was Adam Gopnik on the guitar, accompanied by James Taylor and his wife Kim. James Taylor is currently on tour with Bonnie Raitt through the summer. Next week, I'll talk with Ezekiel Emanuel, a doctor and healthcare policy expert. Emanuel advised President Obama on the Affordable Care Act, and now he's been trying to influence the Republican Party as they set about trying to dismantle it. That's next week. Until then, you can find us on Twitter at New Yorker Radio. I'm David Remnick. Have a great week.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Meryl Garbus of Tune Yards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado. This episode was produced with special help from Rhonda Sherman, David Ohana, Alexis Goldberg, Hillary Leichter, and Jessica Henderson. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.